You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Earlier this week, the government revealed a list of 149 projects that had been selected for fast-tracking. Among the listed fast-tracked projects are 43 infrastructure projects, 22 renewable energy projects, and 11 mining projects. While Infrastructure Minister Chris Bishop says it's... While the bill has not passed yet, Infrastructure Minister Chris Bishop says it's likely some of the projects will be accepted by next year. Both the recently announced list and the fast-track approvals bill preceding it have faced intense scrutiny and criticism from environmental activists who say that it would allow for developers to mining projects and other developments posing risks to the landscape to bypass environmental protections and democratic scrutiny. For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez March about the recently announced fast-track list and the environmental impacts of the projects included in it. We also had a chat about a leaked document revealing a number of cuts to public services and the Finance and Expenditure Committee's inquiry into climate adaptation. To start off, what was your reaction to the recent announcement of the fast-tracked projects list?
Look, this is a Trojan horse approach that will lead to long-term environmental destruction. And we've got to remember that looking after environment isn't some sort of net zero game where we allow things like open cast coal mines that will have irreparable damage in our landscape while also investing in solar panels. We've got to invest in renewable energies, and we also got to divest from things like gold mines that will be mostly used for things like jewelry and open cast coal mines.
I was actually just going to ask you about that. Are there any other specific projects that you believe will have an impact on the environment?
Well, we've got projects like seabed mining. We've got gold mines, open cast coal mines in those lists. And we've got to remember that those projects will lead to species extinction, to irreparable damage to our environment, and will fuel the climate crisis. At a time where we're seeing devastating floods on the South Island, and, you know, only a year and a bit ago here in Auckland, we've got to be doing everything we can to tackle the climate crisis and adequately invest in climate mitigation, adaptation, and renewables.
Included in the list of fast-tracked projects are 44 new housing developments, which would enable the construction of 55,000 new homes in major growth centers across Aotearoa, and 20 renewable energy projects. Do you object to those projects being included in the list as well?
It's the way in which the process has been carried out, which, as I mentioned, it's a Trojan horse approach, because the government is basically showing the, you know, investment in renewables to then shepherd also things like open cast coal mines. If the government wanted to invest in renewables and housing projects, they can do that. They just don't have to also then try and sell us alongside those things, environmentally destructive projects. And it's also rich for the government to be putting housing developments in that list when they are literally taking away resources from Kangaroa and slowing down the build of public housing, which is actually what will lead to more affordable rentals and house prices across our country. So if the government was serious about fixing the housing crisis, they would be investing in Kangaroa rather than having this Trojan horse bill.
Do you think that some of the listed projects, such as the new Alpine Village for Coronet Peak Ski Area and the redevelopment of Eden Park Stadium, need to be fast-tracked and are necessary for rebuilding the economy?
One of the key criticisms that we have had around this bill is that it strips away community consultation and community engagement on these projects. So whether they are things like coal mines or, say, any projects like Eden Park changes. Like at the end of the day, communities are served to have adequate input into these projects. And that's one of the problems with this bill is that it strips communities from being able to engage in massive infrastructure projects too.
Lastly, what do you make of Chris Bishop's assurances that the ministers involved in the fast-tracking process would not have a conflict of interest with any of the listed projects?
Oh, look, this government is at the hand of big corporates, and we're seeing it across different ministerial responsibilities, with Casey Costello echoing big tobacco lines and Shane Jones being basically carried by donations from some of the most environmentally destructive corporations. So I do think that this is a government that is here to serve the interests of big corporates. And I think that's something the public needs to understand, both in terms of how these parties are being funded, but also the kind of language that they're echoing, which comes straight from the mouth of corporates.
All right, moving on to the next topic. A recent document leaked to RNZ has shown that a number of job and funding cuts had been proposed at the National Public Health Service, which oversees health promotion, disease prevention, and protection. The proposed cuts include a $15 million reduction in funding, axing full-time positions in the service, as well as a number of projects and contracts with community organizations. Could you tell us about what your reaction is to this?
We are literally coming out of the worst effects of a global pandemic. An investment in public health should be a priority from this government rather than divesting from resourcing public health, which allows us to be better prepared for new diseases and to also make sure that we are adequately responding to, say, boost immunization rates across the country. This also puts into question the government's lines that they're not cutting frontline services. Public health is a frontline service, and many of these community contracts allow health services to be delivered on the ground and in the community.
A month before these cuts were revealed, Te Whatu Ora Chief Executive Maji Apa had said that a series of changes were needed for the agency to live within its means, but that they wouldn't affect frontline services. Do you think that this recent revelation is going against that promise?
Look, this is a manufactured crisis of austerity where the government is preparing us to driving this narrative that health in New Zealand, Te Whatu Ora, are like basically living beyond its means. But the thing is, we've also got a government that it isn't adequately investing in things like public health. It's also not investing adequately in good, warm, quality public housing to stop people getting sick. So we should not buy these, you know, quote unquote, living within its means narrative for Te Whatu Ora at a time where the government is literally stripping and strangling Te Whatu Ora from having adequate resources to respond to our health and infrastructure crisis.
And do you think that Aotearoa's healthcare system might be heading towards US-styled privatization?
Well, that is the inevitable consequence of stripping our public health system of resources, because if people are struggling to access the public healthcare system, they're going to have to start utilizing the private sector, which is far more expensive and doesn't have the public good at the forefront. And so this is why it is important that we resource things like public health, but that we also have difficult conversations about, for example, our dental care and GP services and why they've been left to the hands of the private sector and how that has not served our communities. So the Greens will push back against any attempts to move to an American-style system where many people just simply cannot access healthcare, like in the US.
All right, moving on to the last topic. Last week, the Finance and Expenditure Committee completed its cross-party inquiry into climate adaptation, which aimed to create a national climate adaptation framework to help both local and central governments prepare for extreme weather events. The inquiry made a series of recommendations to the government to help them plan for extreme weather events more efficiently and to work with iwi and hapu to preserve whenua Māori and uphold te tiriti obligations. So what are your opinions on the findings and recommendations made in the inquiry?
Look, it's really good that we've had a cross-party inquiry into climate adaptation, but the ball now is in the government side to realize that they cannot properly do climate adaptation while also stripping communities and councils from the resources required to better prepare us for extreme weather events. And Dunedin South is a great example where we've got community initiatives in places that are some of the most at risk from rising sea levels in Dunedin and across the country, doing what they can with whatever little resources that they have. But government investment on climate adaptation initiatives would go a long way in places like South Dunedin. And we're seeing the lack of investment reflected in just how much floods can affect places like South Dunedin. So I think now the government needs to invest on climate adaptation as well as mitigation, of course.
One of the inquiry's recommendations involves minimizing long-term costs from both the impacts of extreme weather events and preparedness for them. What impacts do you think this particular recommendation will have on preparing Aotearoa for extreme weather events?
Well, I think there's two things here, right? Like, if we had a government that was genuinely led by data, evidence, and the most available science, they would be building infrastructure that better prepares us for the effects of extreme weather events. So, for example, we wouldn't have such a silly investment and high investment into roads, and rather we would have investment into rail, which not only is more cost efficient to transport goods and services, but also doesn't create as many emissions. And so I think that recommendation should completely overhaul the kind of infrastructure that this government is prioritizing, and would rather should be a signal for the government to invest in things like rail that will better prepare us for extreme weather events, as well as, for example, changing how we do housing development so that we're not building on floodplains still, as we are doing right now.
And lastly, are there any further recommendations the Green Party would make to better prepare communities in Aotearoa for extreme weather events?
So we need to change Hokanga Ora and our housing development agencies to housing so that we're building with nature and not against nature. But at the end of the day, this will require central government resourcing councils, iwi and hapu and whānau, to actually put in place local solutions that work for different communities. And as I've mentioned, for example, Dunedin South is one community that will need its very specific community-led solutions, and it is time that the government resources councils, iwi, hapu and whānau, to be able to do what they need to prepare themselves for extreme weather events that are becoming more frequent.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.